Thank you very much indeed. Good morning. Happy August. I hadn't realised it was August until I was just informed. So today I want to do something a little different. I'm going to take a bit of a detour, but hopefully, certainly, if not by the end of today, certainly by tomorrow, it will... Well, they'll put it this way, the method in the madness will become a little bit clearer. And so hopefully you'll see what I'm trying to get at, and that might help, or it might not. We'll just have to see, won't we? So anyway, I'm glad David's prayed, and we can get stuck in. Now, in the first two sessions, I was thinking about the Old Testament, the resurrection, the ideas, the hints of the resurrection in the Old Testament. And you remember, I was picking up on the fact that even though there are very clear pointers to the cross, there don't seem to be that many very clear pointers to the resurrection, but there are hints. And so as we look back on it, we can see, begin to see how these pieces of the jigsaw fit together. But I think the important thing to realize is that it's very hard. It would have been almost impossible to have done that without having the New Testament in front of us. That gives us the framework, the grid, by which to hold these things together. That's basically like having the picture on the box of the puzzle. Whereas the Old Testament by itself is, you've just got some bits. You don't even have the whole story, and you're trying to sort of make head or tail of the whole thing. But we've now got the box and the whole package, if you like, so we know what it's about. And actually, it's fitted very nicely into what we've been doing in the evenings, if you've been coming to the celebrations from John 20 and 21. Now, what I want to think tomorrow about is the difference that Jesus' resurrection makes for, well, our present as it leads into the future. In other words, from now on in to eternity. But today, I want to think about the present, but in such a way as that actually it shapes the way we even think, the way we see our world, excuse me, and understand ourselves, how we gain a sense of our identity as Christian believers. So in a sense, this is where the rubber really begins to hit the road. I mean, we've been thinking about the past, and indeed the ancient past. And a lot of the time, I don't know about you, but you'd be reading bits of the Old Testament, and it feels incredibly remote, alien. And it's very hard to see where this might have anything to do with living in the 21st century and all that, that entails. You know, we talk about where the rubber hits the road, and, you know, where this really makes a difference. And I, as a preacher, say that a lot of the time, but I'm not sure I have been helped, nor am I sure that I help others very much, how to do that. What actually might help as a process of thought and prayer, actually to make it really sink in. And sometimes, you know, we hear statements of faith, we hear, you know, points of confessional truth that have been handed down the generations, and we say, yeah, great, I believe that, or I want to believe that, and I want it to make a difference. But then you sort of think, well, now what? And if there's one verse that sums up this morning, it's a verse that actually directly applies the reality of the resurrection on the here and now. And it's from 2 Corinthians, verse 4. And it's part of a wonderful, more extended passage. But here is what Paul says. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we're wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. It says what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Here we are in the present, in the now. We have the framework of the future in eternity. And you see, that reshapes, realigns actually what we think. This is about the renewing and the deepening, the changing, the transforming of our minds, of what we think, how we perceive the world. But do you see, this is all in the light of the fact that Jesus is alive. Now, we're going to come back to that. This is sort of setting the scene for the whole thing. But let's do something just to get our brains in gear, because I don't know about you, but I'm feeling fairly comatose. You might have picked that up already. And I'm going to make three statements, and then I'm going to ask you just to chat to a neighbor or someone near you. Certainly someone near you, not someone at the back. We can't have that. And I want you just to see what you make of these different statements. They're not going to be that unfamiliar, I'm sure, but just discuss the difference between them, where they have a place, where you might use one or all of these three statements. Okay, so here we go. Here are the three statements. The first is, I believe in the resurrection of the body and the life everlasting. The second is this, because the evidence for Jesus rising from the dead is clear and persuasive, I know I too will rise with him. And then the third is this, I try to imagine the reality of my life being hidden with the risen Christ as I begin each day. Okay? They are three different ways of thinking about, well, the resurrection. So just chat with a neighbor or hopefully a friend, if not now, then by the end of the session, and see what are the differences? Where might you use these different statements, and what impact do they have? So over to you. Okay. Maybe that will have stimulated a conversation that can carry on afterwards, or not. And unfortunately, we can't sort of all feedback because that would be chaotic. But let me just sort of pinpoint one or two things about these statements. I hope that was at least a vaguely interesting conversation. So the first, obviously, is a very ancient statement. It comes from the Apostles' Creed. It is a statement of our heritage of 2,000 years of church history, essentially. And it's a public affirmation. So by standing and saying those words, as well as the rest of the creed, we are kind of publicly identifying with this heritage. It's a very important thing to do, I think. But in itself, it doesn't necessarily imply very much. It certainly doesn't necessarily imply understanding or having worked it through or whatever. But it's not a small thing, but it's not everything. It's a statement of belief, whatever that might mean. The second is also a statement, and it's to do with ideas and propositions and truth, but it's made a bit more personal, isn't it? And it's to do with working through a sort of a certain historical logic. And it's the kind of thing that I have to do from time to time. I have to rehearse, if you like, the reasons for my belief, because I wake up sometimes in the morning and think, what on earth am I doing in this job? What is the point? Why do I believe this stuff? It just seems fanciful and nonsensical. And you wouldn't believe how, well, perhaps you would, but I have to go back to first base again and again and again and actually just preach to myself, to work it through, say, well, why is it? Am I doing this again? And the historicity, the fact of this happening in history is a very important, crucial element of this. And working through the logic again is something I need to do with sort of a frightening degree of regularity. The third, though, takes it into a whole different realm, but it's still to do with the same beliefs, but it is deeply personalized, and it's about trying to conceive of something that you cannot see, for which there's no tangible evidence whatsoever, and convincing yourself that this is real. And that seems, well, to some, that seems a positively dangerous thing to do. Are you convincing yourself of something that just frankly isn't true? But you see, at work here is our imagination, because we are deciding to ignore the evidence of our senses and saying, I am united to Christ and I am being renewed day by day. My life is hidden with Christ. So, you know, if you think of Paul's letters, all of the people to whom Paul writes have two addresses, Colossae or Philippi or Thessaloniki, and the heavenly realms. Where are we? If we are in Christ, we are in Keswick and in the heavenly realms, simultaneously, two different planes of existence that already have happened. But if you ask me to give you categorical and impenetrable evidence, unassailable evidence that you are in the heavenly realms, there's nothing I can show you apart from some verses. And if you believe that, you are having to use your imagination. Do you see what I'm getting at? So what I want to do today is actually try and sort of take a little bit of a detour and say, why is our imagination important and how do we use it best in our discipleship? And I would say, and this is something I've only really been working and coming to terms with just in the last 5 to 10 years, but I would say that actually, if we are not seeking to do this, then our Christian discipleship will be majorly impoverished. And actually, I think in some ways, become harder. And I just wonder whether this is one reason why people struggle so much. It's because they're not encouraged to use their imagination. But I am well aware that using a word like imagination is going to press some people's red buttons. The first sort of danger, I guess, is that it kind of plays into the hands of skeptics, of people who dismiss religion and Christianity in particular. You know, the classic barb, isn't it, from the new atheists and others, is that basically to be a Christian, to be a religious believer, is believing something you know you would love to be true, but isn't. In other words, I mean, that's kind of a definition of a fantasist, isn't it? Believing something you know isn't true. How would a pastor come back at that, I wonder? Well, you see, here's the thing. God has revealed himself in Christ and then in his written word, and so he assures us we do not need to grope around in the dark to try and find him. That he comes looking for us. He's been doing that since Eden. He's made himself known, as John chapter 1 reminds us. This is true, but we need our imaginations to work that out, work it through into all its implications. You see, the point is, the Bible provides us with boundaries for our imagination. In other words, this over here is not true, but this is true. And so your imagination needs to try and live in this space that is bounded by what Scripture reveals. And it takes us on a journey to where God wants to take us. And if you're going to get closer to God, then the flight path to your destination doesn't feel like a constraint at all. Those boundaries are actually helping you keep on track. Those boundaries are a great blessing and benefit. So we are deliberately avoiding things that are not true. But we're trying to grasp the fullness and the reality of what the Bible says is true. So perhaps you could see, oh, I've just suddenly realized I've missed about five paragraphs, which is why none of that made sense, did it? But nobody picked me up. You just carried on looking at me and thinking, oh, he's speaking something I don't understand. Well, I don't understand what I was saying. I'm going to go back a bit. That was very weird because I suddenly started talking about pastors and that didn't make sense. Please forgive me. I have had two coffees today, but probably that was an error. Okay, I'm talking about skeptics, aren't I? And I wasn't, but I meant to be. Okay. It's all fun, isn't it? We're friends, and this is going out on the internet. Fantastic. Right. So skeptics insist that we are fantasists, and we don't stick to our notes. And basically, we believe something that we know isn't true. Now, I don't know whether... Do you remember hearing about these humanist youth camps that used to happen? They still happen, apparently. But it hit the headlines, I don't know, about 15 years ago. Richard Dawkins was a patron, and there were all kinds of things. And basically, they were designed for children from free-thinking homes. Well, that's lovely. And they happened in the States and in this country, and they drew lots of people. And they would have lots of activities and games. Apparently, one of the most popular games is called Hunt the Unicorns. And the kids are told at the beginning that there are two invisible unicorns who live on the camp, but they are undetectable by sound, smell, or trace. However, the kids are told, every leader believes emphatically in these unicorns because of some ancient book that then no one else is allowed to read. And the game... I mean, it sounds great, but the game is whoever successfully proves the unicorn's non-existence will get a prize of a £10 note with Charles Darwin's face on it, signed by Richard Dawkins. Now, it's not hard to see what it's getting at. It's all very crude and not subtle in the slightest. Believing in something because of some ancient book that you're not allowed to read. It's delusional. Believing something you know isn't true. It's delusional. Now, that's quite the insult, isn't it? Nobody wants to be actually delusional. Not least because it enables the skeptic to be smug and superior because they obviously believe something that is true. And we're just a bunch of morons for believing something that isn't true. So when I talk about imagine being raised with Christ, it sounds dangerously like go and find the unicorns in the wood. There's no evidence. It doesn't smell different. It doesn't taste or feel. In fact, to use the word as it used to be understood, it is not sensible. In other words, it cannot be sensed. So we have a problem. We have to take it as read. We take it as true. We take it on the basis of somebody's word. So then the issue is, can that word, can that person be trusted? Is their word reliable? Now, I believe that it is, and I believe that there are good reasons to believe this. So it's not insane, and it's not delusional because of the things we believe about this person who has authority. But we're going to have to use our imaginations to figure out what that means in our own lives. Do you see what I'm getting at? Hopefully that makes a bit more sense now. Or not. You can come back at me in Q&A. The danger of imagination, firstly, is it appears to confirm every prejudice that the skeptics have against us. And I feel that accusation acutely when I'm talking about this imagination thing. But the second thing, and this is what I did start saying, and now I'll explain why. But basically, I think some pastors assume or fear that if we encourage people's imagination, it'll run riot and go off in all kinds of different directions, and that will be really unhelpful. And that's believing something that you would like to be true rather than something you know isn't true. So the skeptics will accuse us of being delusional. I think pastors are worried we'll become fantasists. And this is the point about the Bible giving us boundaries. It's giving us a flight path to the destination. So we know what it's going to be to some extent. We're not imagining in all kinds of different directions and it's just free for all in whatever you like. Or perhaps we could see, and there are limits to this illustration as well, but there's a sense in which perhaps the Bible is like a jazz standard. You know, the classic songs, the Great American Songbook, as it's sometimes described, the classic songs that everybody knows and recognizes, but the gift and the wonder of the jazz player is they use their imagination to weave around it, but actually to be faithful to it at the same time. To figure out, what does it mean here and now as I'm playing this song? And the Bible is full of stuff that puzzles, perplexes, and actually even confuses us. It demands our time to think and pray, to meditate on, and even imagine. Why else do writers use so much poetry? Poetry is deliberately provocative and sometimes deeply confusing. Sometimes you might have to wrestle with what a poet has said in words that by themselves are very simple and obvious and concrete, but you put them together and you think, what is that? And it sort of niggles away at you, it needles you, but you keep thinking about it. And actually, that very process of trying to get your head into the same space as the poet is precisely the point. It's about really trying to imagine what is in view. So we're not talking about stuff that is out of control. We don't believe whatever we like. We're simply trying to imagine the reality that is that exists because of what God has done, is doing, and will do. That's why there are so many similes and stories. In fact, more or less everything that Jesus taught is an act of the imagination. I've been trying to write a novel for about 7 years, and my hope, if not fear, is that I'll complete it next year. I've been saying that for 7 years. But I remember talking to somebody, and you know, they were saying, well, what are you working on for your next book? And I said, well, actually trying to write a novel. And he looked at me like I was a complete alien. Why would you do that? I just said, well, I actually think stories are quite important. Really? Well, I think that's pretty much all Jesus did, to tell stories, not exclusively. But he was using fiction all the time. What are the parables if not fiction? There was not a good Samaritan. He didn't exist. There was not an unjust steward. There were not 10 bridesmaids. But it's not hard to imagine them because there were bridesmaids all over the place. And, you know, there were travelers on the Jericho Road all the time. And there were robbers and thieves and mustard seeds and trees and fruit and vineyards and things all the time. You know, you couldn't move without spotting all of these things. But he's provoking you. He's saying, okay, well, in what sense is the kingdom like a mustard seed? And, you know, something like that is just a sort of throwaway line. And you have to think. You have to conjure up in your mind a mustard seed. Well, if you're an urbanite, you probably don't know what that means. Never seen a mustard seed. You have to dig around. You have to work. But for those in Jesus' time, they knew exactly what it looked like, but they had to think about and imagine what it meant. Well, let me give a bit more of a sort of biblical backbone very briefly, and then I'll look at some ways in which the resurrection needs to be worked into our lives through our imagination. So the first point is having a biblical imagination. So this is just an outflowing of that very first verse. that I looked at from Corinthians. But let me throw another one into the mix, and I think it's the combination of these two, that 2 Corinthians verse and this one from Hebrews 11. Again, very familiar, but just think about this. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Confidence for the future, assurance about the invisible. You have to use your imagination, don't you? Because you've never experienced either. You don't know. You are not from the future. And yes, we're doing pretty well at uncovering some of the mysteries of the invisible. So we've got things like microscopes and telescopes. But there's a lot that they can never see. And so Paul says, outwardly, we're wasting away. There's the visible. Inwardly, we're being renewed day by day. Where's the evidence of that? Well, I can't see any. I mean, you look lovely. But I don't see you being renewed with the glories of heaven. Do you? We take it on faith. I'm in my 50s now. I'm already creaking. Bits are falling off. It's all going wrong. And I know it's only going to accelerate. I'm wasting away, and so are you. In fact, apparently, we start wasting away at 18 or something. So that's great, isn't it? Paul speaks truer than perhaps even he knew. So the evidence for me being renewed seems weak at best. But I would say it is a reasonable imagination. It's not fantasists, it's reasons. Now, the person who helped me most, and I think some of you may have found this as well, who really helped me most with this imagination business is, of course, C.S. Lewis. And for him, the imagination was absolutely essential to his faith. And that's why, for instance, his friendship with Tolkien and the others in the Inklings was so crucial, because they were deeply brilliant intellects, that group, who delighted in the imagination. Lewis said this, "For me, reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the organ of meaning." So you work out what is true, that's your reason, but you don't necessarily work out its significance or what it means to you until you start using your imagination. He says, imagination producing new metaphors or revivifying old is not the cause of truth, but its condition. It helps you live in the truth. If you don't use your imagination, then it's a remote, stale, sometimes dead statement. Imagination is about, what does this mean for me? Reason will tell you what is. And so we use our reason out of the scriptures. We're using our mind. Ours is not a blind faith, it's a reasoned faith. There are reasons. And, you know, people have used their reason and their understanding and so on to build, say, a systematic theology, to try and see the threads and bring them all together. That is all part and necessary for our Christian maturity. But the imagination says, so what? So what? What is the significance of this? What does it mean? And it's a matter of casting to mind something that hasn't happened yet. And that could be as simple as planning a menu for people coming for a meal. You're using your imagination because you haven't had that meal yet. And you're imagining, okay, we got Fred and Ginger coming for lunch on Sunday. What do they like to eat? You're using your imagination when you go to Tesco. Or you're putting yourself into somebody else's shoes. What must it be like for that person to have to deal with this? Empathy. Empathy is an act of the imagination. In other words, it's deliberately saying, I'm going to step outside my reality and try, to the best of my ability, walk in somebody else's reality. You can't do empathy without imagination. Because it means you're just stuck in your own little bubble. Incidentally, I think that's why all pastors should read fiction. Because fiction is all about living in other people's shoes. And so it is essential. Lewis very helpfully described three ways in which imagination works. And it's interesting, I've been thinking quite a bit about this, but I remember when I was about 9 or 10, and we've all had them, haven't we? But I had a teacher who I didn't gel with, and he didn't like me at all, and he was teaching English. You know, he clearly didn't have much time for me. And, you know, at a sort of parent-teacher evening, he just said to my parents, mum and dad, that he didn't think I had any imagination. Now, my mum is an artist. She's a painter. She's nearly 80, and she's still painting. I spoke to her just a couple of days ago on her birthday, and she was in her little shed studio thing, and she was still painting. Imagination has been absolutely crucial to her and all my life. She's been encouraging my brother and I to be really doing this. And so for her, this was an extraordinarily shocking statement. He doesn't really have an imagination. In other words, I just do what I'm told. And she trained at art schools, and so she knew that it was a fatuous and absurd thing to say. All it proved was that this teacher didn't know me, because everybody's got an imagination. Absolutely everybody. Just not everybody uses it that much, nor is it shaped in the same way. But everybody's got one. I think also what he was saying is that I wasn't original. I never did anything original. Well, fair enough. I was 9. And it took me years to come out of my shell. I wouldn't say boo to a goose. The idea, I think when I was 17 or 18, the idea that my job would be a public speaking job was insane. I struggled enough to speak in a group of 5. Well, Lewis understood there were 3 different understandings, different ways, and they're sort of, they weave in between each other. One is wish fulfillment. In other words, a longing for something. And that has biblical roots. God set eternity in the hearts of man, that Ecclesiastes 3 says. It's a longing for something which leads to certain actions now. It could be positive, it could be negative, it could be healthy, it could be deeply unhealthy. But that is the imagination at work. You are imagining an outcome from something you are longing for, and you think you found, if you like, the vehicle to get you there, or the road to get you there. It might be to escape from the pains of this world, you take narcotics. That comes out of a longing. Or you are so in despair of the world that I've got one friend who is just obsessed with the theater and has worked behind the scenes in theaters and knows how to get cheap tickets, and basically will be at the theatre 3 or 4 nights a week in London. You know, standing at the back if necessary, doesn't care about being comfortable, but it's just getting escape from the world by this nightly, almost, escape. Now, of course, that's quite sort of rarefied to do it in the theatre, but we all do it with ITV. It's not that different. Whatever it is. And I think for preachers, this is crucial to understand. We need to understand, what are our people's longings? Sometimes we're very quick to dismiss them as idols, and that gives us a great excuse to beat people over the head with the sin of their idolatry. Yes, idolatry comes into it, but it's bigger than that, and it's actually more positive than that, because God has placed these longings in our hearts, and the question is, can we redirect them to the things that really are eternal? That's a positive thing. to shift one's imagination onto things that really do last. The great Scottish preacher Thomas Chalmers described that preaching the gospel would lead to what he called the expulsive power of a new affection. In other words, I'm longing for this thing in this world, and it sort of satisfies, and then in the end completely doesn't. But we have something that is far more glorious and strong and enables us to push out the temporary in favor of the eternal. And so this means that whoever we're with, we've got something in common. Whether they work for the Taliban, the National Secular Society, the NHS, you name it, whatever. We share this. A second use of imagination is in invention. And I guess that's what often people think imagination is all about, that it's about being able to invent something that, you know, something new, something that doesn't exist. It's using usually materials that already exist and is usually an adaptation of something that already exists or a whole group of things, but here is just one permutation that changes everything and that makes it new. If you look at the history of painting and the history of art, and you just know a few of the sort of famous paintings, and you sort of think they have come out of the ether, out of a vacuum. You know, the Mona Lisa, suddenly there was the Mona Lisa, or suddenly there was Monet's haystacks. And if you don't know the art history, then you're not going to realize that there are so many incremental changes and adaptations and ideas by scores, hundreds of different artists, men and women, all kinds of cultures, doing different things. And then just suddenly, there is a kind of alchemy, and it really works so that the next step sings. But all of them along that way have, whether they're famous and known or not, been at work constantly inventing. It doesn't mean, though, it has to be original. I think that, going back to my teacher when I was 9, I think that was one of the problems. He's just thinking, oh, well, he's not very original. And maybe you're thinking, well, I'm not very original. I couldn't write a song or a poem or whatever. And so you think, well, I'm not very imaginative. You'd be amazed. It takes great imagination to do most things in life. Even to tidy a bedroom, would you believe it? Now, obviously, this innovation is key to the creative industries, but it's not just them. It's the key, for instance, to a prophetic ministry, not by which I don't mean predicting stuff in the future, but I mean prophetic in the sense that the Old Testament prophets were. In other words, positing a society that could and should be not the one as it is. You know, political change comes about because people have imagined what they say is a better world. It might be worse, but that's what they catch you up in, isn't it? Change is here, and you want to be part of it. That's your imagination. It doesn't have to be like this. That's your imagination. But the third that Lewis really homed in on is this, the perception of deep reality. In other words, he understood that in the Christian life, you need your imagination to perceive things that the world cannot. And once you see it, you'll find this almost on every page of the Bible, certainly the New Testament. The peace the world cannot give. Well, what on earth's that like? Though outwardly we're wasting away, inwardly we are being renewed. This is a kind of empathy as well. I see somebody suffering and their lives perhaps they're a complete mess, and I think, oh, well, I wouldn't have done what they did. But saying, okay, well, in other circumstances, if I'd been in those circumstances, is it possible that I might have done and that actually I can sympathize with their predicament and maybe empathize with it, stand in their shoes, and therefore not judge them but love them? Perceiving a deeper reality. But of course, ultimately, this means the gospel. Perceive the deep reality of the gospel in the past, in the present, in the future. A life of faithful imagination. That's what this is all about. So I'm going to close with three ways in which this works out. The confidence in what we hope for, and the assurance about what we do not see. And it will always involve placing ourselves on this big timeline between the deep past, the invisible present, and the eternal future. And I think part of Christian discipleship is being able to imagine us on this timeline in parallel with, if you like, the sort of thing that would be in a biography, in an obituary or something like that. Do I perceive where I fit in these realities? Because the New Testament is constantly getting us to see things that way. Your reason won't. Your reason will give you, if you like, the tools. It'll give you the ingredients. But it's only your imagination that's going to work out, okay, what does that mean for me? And do I really hold on to this? And how might that change me as I'm waiting for this bus that's late and I'm getting tetchy and annoyed? So what might these three things be? Well, the present reality of the church is that we are, well, I don't need you to need to tell you, and I hear a lot these days, and I feel it personally and acutely, the church leaves a lot to be desired, and very often people are fearful of the church because they're afraid of what large groups of people led by a small group with a lot of power, and especially if they have a lot of money, might do to people who don't quite fit or conform. Personally, I am very scared of committees, especially committees that meet in secret and don't have transparency and make decisions that affect lots of people, but not always in full openness so that they don't know what's been said about them. And I've heard over the years so many situations where people have been told one thing, but behind closed doors, another thing has been said and decided. I think Christians with a lot of power and a lot of money scare the living daylights out of me. They really do. And I'm struggling, to be honest, struggling not to be a cynic. I think that is my biggest battle as a believer now, is to resist cynicism. Because, you know, we're a ragbag bunch of different people. We're disunited. We pull in different directions. We have, all kinds of agendas that are hidden, sometimes that we don't even know ourselves. As individuals, we're finite, we're flawed, we're broken, we're wasting away, we're dying. And basically, the sum of these parts is deeply unimpressive and feels less than the total. Paul in Corinthians says, don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple? And God's Spirit lives among you. If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy this person, for God's temple is sacred, and you together are that temple. You. In other words, you are the place people meet God. In the ancient world, people would travel for miles and miles to come to the Jerusalem temple. We don't have that anymore. Jesus is the temple himself, of course, which is why people were so confused in John's gospel. You know, they didn't understand he was talking about his body. But if you extend the metaphor, it's extraordinary. Basically, he's saying it's as if the world would stream to come on pilgrimage to the temple. And you think, seriously? It takes quite a lot of imagination. But that's what Paul says we are. And of course, he applies it to us as individuals. The temple he'd spoken of was his body. And he says, don't you know that your bodies are a temple of the Spirit? Where did you meet God in the ancient world? The temple on Zion. Where did you meet God in the Gospels? Jesus. Where do you meet God now? His temple. Us. Doesn't feel right. But we take it on faith. And people come to the temple to meet with God. And the extraordinary thing, if you extend the metaphor, it's basically saying you meet with his people. Now, you don't identify the people as God. So you don't say the kingdom of heaven is the church visible. That's a very dangerous thing to do. And when that happens, you either end up in cults or very powerful institutions. Because they say, we are God. We are the voice of God to you. Therefore, do what we tell you. But we are the temple of God by his Spirit in the Lord Jesus Christ. That takes an act of the imagination. It's true. Or take another one. You yourselves are our letter. 2 Corinthians 3. You are our letter, written on our hearts, known and read by everyone. You show that you are a letter from Christ, the result of our ministry, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God. Not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Here you have Paul playing around with his metaphors. I mean, he was a poet in a way, a sort of theological poet. He was constantly using metaphors and sometimes extending them quite far. But in the ancient world, you know, you didn't have LinkedIn, you didn't have CVs, you didn't have sort of ways of verifying different people. You couldn't sort of stalk their Twitter feed to check that they're not cancelable. So what you would do is you would take a letter of recommendation, which actually was, well, in some places is still very significant. You take a letter of recommendation to the next place, and, you know, if Fred over here knows Ginger in that place, then Fred will write a letter to Ginger so that when Paul turns up, oh, he's all right, this one. Because there were charlatans around, all over the place, all kinds of dodgy geezers. Now, Paul and his ministry were under attack in Corinth constantly. I suspect Corinth caused Paul more heartache than any other place. And he'd basically been crucial to its founding under God. And they were just turning their backs on him and saying, no, we want people who are a bit more exciting, who've got a better message, who you know, have something that is more accessible. We want to be able to see something and feel something and touch something. We want something tangible and impressive so that the world will say, wow, look at them. Paul's not having a moment of it. No, because outwardly we're wasting away. There's nothing we can do about changing that. There's no amount of plastering on makeup and tan and everything else to make you look as though you are eternal. Nothing you can do. And the more you try, the more grotesque you become. But inwardly, we're being renewed. And so Paul says to the Corinthians, look, we've got letters of recommendation. It's the fact you're Christian and that God is at work in you. How did that happen if it wasn't for our ministry? You are our letters of recommendation. Do you see the point? They look confused and doubting because they are. They're inarticulate, they're hypocritical. They're disunified. But God is at work, and that is a miracle. So I sometimes think, do you know what? The thing that encourages me most about the New Testament, especially on days when I'm thinking, man, it's tough, in this part of the world because people are just so jaundiced and they think they are post-Christian when in fact they're really pre-Christian and they think they're rejecting the gospel but they don't know what the gospel is. And I keep coming back and I say, but Mark, there was a church in Corinth. There was a church in Corinth. Can you believe it? You are our letters of recommendation. Finally, you are living ambassadors. We implore as Christ's ambassadors, making his appeal. An ambassador has to be faithful to the government they represent. If the government changes, as has happened in this country very recently, I got friends in the Foreign Office, they have to change their tunes on a dime if that's what the political masters back home say. So a foreign policy could change overnight with a different person in the hot seat. They cannot represent the previous government's view or they'll be out of a job. Now, our government doesn't change. We have the Lord Jesus. We are to be faithful to him. But we don't look impressive and we're not very articulate. And we are not all on message together, are we? But that's what we are. And I think that's, again and again, why the New Testament, and Paul in particular, his appeal for holiness is an appeal to be what you are. You are ambassadors. You are living letters. You are the temple. So jolly well be it. We've got less than 5 minutes for questions. Let's see how we do. So we're going to have some speedy Olympian microphone runners. And they're coming out of their...
curtains.
What are those things on horse racing? You know, the starting blocks. Here they come.
Right.
And hands up if you have a question. There's a question over here. Thank you so much, brother. 1970 is a great year.
How important or strategic is the imagination for intercessory prayer?
How important and strategic is the imagination for intercessory prayer? That's a lovely question. And it's similar to what it means to be prophetic, isn't it? Because you are trying to imagine what could be, as well as what has been promised to be. And in fact, you know, the Puritans would talk about suing God to keep his promises. I mean, it's not like taking God to court as such, but saying, hey, Lord, you promised this, but I don't see it. So, absolutely. Whereas if you're stuck with the status quo, with the present, with what you see is all there is, then you cannot imagine it any other way, and you're not going to ask for that. So I think it's probably, yeah, it's the sort of center of gravity even for it. Okie dokie. Yes, just behind. Yeah.
Just following on from that question before, I mean, Is our daily prayer and the work of the Holy Spirit, should we kind of almost relax and use those to help our imagination flow, knowing that we're guided by the Spirit in our prayer life?
Yes, I think so. I mean, look, everything that makes us human is a gift of the Creator. Now, it doesn't mean to say that the exercise of all those gifts is good and we can use them all for ill and people can use their imagination for terrible ill. It's like electricity. It's like if you're very muscular, it's not something I've ever really been able to experience. But, you know, if you're very strong and muscly, you can do all kinds of things with that. You might be able to lift, I don't know, a boulder away from a door, or you might be able to punch someone's brains out. Great. But your imagination is a neutral thing, but it's a gift of God. So we surrender that to the Lord. and say, Lord, use this and help me live out what you call me to. And I apply my imagination to do that. Over there in the middle.
Yeah, you mentioned the new atheists, and they may be in decline, but we're still very much products of modernity.
Yes.
How does the imagination play into that whole kind of debate between science and faith?
Yeah, this is so important. By the way, it's 7:30, so if you need to slip away, then feel free. I'm just going to carry on for 2 or 3 minutes, if that's all right. On this issue, I could speak for 5 hours, and I will. Here we are in Keswick, in the lakes. The person who helped Lewis more than anybody else figure this exact question out was Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And Coleridge and Wordsworth were just up the road, and they hung out around here. And to begin with, certainly when they were in their sort of wandering daisy, marigold, daffodil, lonely as cloud phase, they were sort of kind of on the verge of worshipping the natural world. It was kind of pantheistic, God in everything, or God is everything, and it was fairly pagan. I don't know as much about Wordsworth, but it's absolutely clear that Coleridge, by the end of his life, was a full-going Trinitarian creedal believer. And he was somebody for whom the imagination was everything, but he was also fantastically interested in science. There's a wonderful book by Richard Holmes called The Age of Wonder. And my old understanding of the Romantic movement was that it's a rejection of Enlightenment thinking. In other words, we just basically need to commune with the bushes and the daffodils and get rid of this awful Industrial Revolution rubbish. Well, they were reacting against the Industrial Revolution. But, you know, Coleridge and others, they would be there at the Christmas lectures at the Royal Society with Faraday and others every year. They couldn't get enough of it. They were obsessed with this newfangled electricity and so on. And that's why you get, for instance, Mary Shelley, as a very young woman, writing Frankenstein. That's all about this newfangled invention of electricity and what it might be able to do. You know, revivification. Might you be able to get body parts and make them alive again? You know, that is a scientific question, but seen through the lens of somebody with deep imagination saying, what if? Coleridge was the person who really thought about, okay, well, how do we hold these things under God as his gifts in right connection? And there's a very wonderful short poem. Lewis wrote a lot of poetry. There's a short poem, maybe even a sonnet, I can't quite remember, but it's very short. It's just called Reason. Now, Malcolm Guite has written a lot about Coleridge and Lewis, and he thinks that title was imposed later. But if you want to find it, it's just called Reason. And basically, in that poem, he works out what Coleridge taught him, which is that actually, what I was saying earlier, reason gives you the raw materials for your imagination to get to work with. So if it didn't, it would be pure fantasy. So it's not a rejection of science, it's not a rejection of the intellect, it's not a rejection of reason. And in fact, every good scientist has amazing imagination. They couldn't do their science without imagination. Otherwise, they just do the same thing that has always been done. Whereas a scientist will say, well, what if I do it this way? That's imagination at work. And then you try and work out, well, what's the significance? Here are the results. And then you have to say, okay, what does this mean? And you form a theory. That's imagination. Or you form a metaphor. Light is particles and waves. Both of those are metaphors. They're not literal. But they are using imagination to say, okay, well, how can we make sense of this data? And that's exactly the same process as the believer. It's no different. We are not anti-science. We're not anti-reason. We're not anti-intellect. We are saying, and this is the problem with the Enlightenment, and this is what the Romantics were really saying, the original sin, if you like, of Romanticism, of the Enlightenment is reductionism. It's to say the world is just the data. And that is dehumanizing and catastrophic. Goodbye.